Philip Morgan.
Liston Witherill. Howdy.
In the flesh. How are you?
Good. I think I may actually, after this, kind of knock off for the day. I rarely do that, but I think I think I can afford to do it. I think I've got my to-do list whittled down to the point where I could do it. So I'm good. How are you?
I'm good also. I gave a long webinar today, and I think I'm going to go to the gym after this and then just chill a little bit simply because I'm a little brain dead. It's not because my to-do list is so small, but I think I need a little bit of rest here.
Yeah, you probably do. How'd the webinar go?
It went well. Yeah, good turnout. So I promoted it on LinkedIn for the first time ever. And I also promoted it on my email list, obviously. And what I didn't know was how many people signed up through LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, I uploaded my registration list to my email service provider. And what I found was I think I only added something like 20 subscribers. But, of course, people could have signed up to my other things in the interim. Mm-hmm. But, it went well. Good turnout. Lots of questions, lots of engagement, filled up an hour and a half, no problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Congrats.
So, Philip, today I think I'm going to promote, once again, my salesin30.com course. That is www.salesin30.com. And you can get a free 10-video course. And I was contacted in the last week by someone who signed up for that and heard our LinkedIn episode, which I pretty sure he found through a keyword search on Apple Podcasts. So Philip, even though you like to joke about our 40 subscribers, which actually other people have mentioned to me, so stop it.
Okay.
We actually have more than 40 subscribers now because we're routinely getting quite a bit more than that. And we're on traffic on pace to increase our traffic here by like 30 to 40% month over month for about four straight months. So thanks for listening to everybody listening to this.
Oh, my jokes go out of date so fast. So I'm curious what feedback you've gotten about this Sales in 30 course. Surely someone has said something about it.
Not a lot of constructive feedback that could be useful in improving or altering the course.
Yeah.
But mostly just positive stuff, right?
People say, high fives, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Like this is really reminding me about everything I should be paying attention to. This is changing the way I think about the way I approach sales. This is such a reminder that sales is a conversation. It's not me doing something to someone, which, you know, all of these things are exactly what I'm hoping to get across. So that gives me the warm and fuzzies because I think I've done something right.
That sounds great. Well, I'm going to promote something today that only three people have complimented me on, and I'm okay with that.
And I'm one of them?
I don't know. You tell me. I think it's far more important than people realize. But I'm struggling to fully explain this concept. Anyway, the thing I want people to check out, if they have not already, is a conversation I had with David C. Baker. It's on my podcast, the Consulting Pipeline Podcast. It's episode 90.
Wow.
And we can link to that in the show notes. I had a great time talking to David. We were talking about this thing that I think is kind of a mystery to a lot of the folks I'm working with. And that's why I think maybe not a lot of folks understand the importance of this podcast. It's something I'm going to be elaborating on, I think, for the next 6 to 12 months, not constantly, but it'll be a big thread in what I'm talking about. And here's what it is. It's like, okay, it's pretty obvious how we get smarter in a general sense. And it's pretty obvious that if you want to charge more, an easy way to do that is for what you do to be more valuable to your clients. I know that's sort of a circular definition. It's like, want to charge more, be worth more. But also, it really is that simple. It's not that easy, but it is that simple. Just do things that are worth more. The question then is, how do you get from, okay, I understand that I want to have this expertise that is more valuable. How do you actually create that expertise? I say you specialize, you narrow down, you focus. And a lot of other people say that too, and it's true. But is there something in the middle that I think is a real mystery to people? It's, and they need to see more examples of how that works. And that's something I'm going to be working on trying to do. This conversation with David Baker is a good sort of starting point for that whole idea of how you get smarter faster, how you make your services worth more to your clients. And so that's what I'd like folks to check out if they're so inclined.
And so that's at consultingpipelinepodcast.com, and it's episode 90. Or you could just go subscribe to it on the iTunes or podcast catcher of your choice, Consulting Pipeline Podcast.
And then you could listen to all 91 episodes if you're so inclined.
And I will confess, Philip, I haven't heard this yet. So I'm actually going to grab this when I go to the gym after I talk to you, because, you know, I just need you in my head constantly, I guess.
But it makes life better when I'm there at all times.
Well, I'm really curious to hear what David says about this. And actually, I wanted to ask you a related question. I was listening to the Akimbo podcast, which I saw you tweeted about recently. That's Seth Godin's new podcast. Yeah. And the episode, I think that came out today, was about the placebo effect. And so he talked about all of the mountains of evidence that the placebo effect works. And one of the points he was making is, well, if the placebo effect works and you have a business, why wouldn't you employ it in your business? Meaning, one of the heuristics we use is expensive is better, right? Mm-hmm. So he talked about wine, like, and how sommeliers, if you put duct tape over wine bottles, can't really tell the difference between expensive wine. Mm-hmm. It's also been proven that so-called art experts can't tell the difference between good art and authentic and faked art, right? It's a related idea. But essentially the point he was making is if you charge more, your clients are more likely to feel a stronger transformation. That doesn't give you permission to be shitty at your job or to not improve or to become more valuable, but it does imply that higher rates will send the signal to the buyer that they're more invested and they're getting something better. What's your thought on that?
I love that. I feel like this might end up being what we talk about for the most of today's episode. Big Seth Godin fan, and I'm really liking this podcast. I feel like he's this sort of master storyteller. So I think we can exclude from this stuff like absolute commodities, like data entry. Are you going to feel better about getting, you know, these 1,000 pages of paper converted into electronic form if you spent more on the data entry person? I doubt it. Like, so he's not talking about commodities. I get the sense that he's talking about something where the client has to participate in a way that involves change on their part. And in that situation specifically, I absolutely agree that the more skin in the game they have financially, the more motivated they will tend to be to do what's necessary on their end to create the result. So even with, you know, done-for-you services, like, hey, I'm going to build a website for you, the client has to participate. They have to say, they have to provide feedback, they have to provide direction or insight into what problem's being solved or what needs to be different as a result of this work. And the quality of their participation in that way, I think, changes when you're charging more. Your very good friend, Alan Weiss, I think would agree. He's said a number of times in a number of books that, you know, being cheap doesn't do any favors to a consultant who's there to try to help the organization change, because they don't feel any pain. They don't feel like they're going to miss out on something amazing or waste a bunch of money if they don't take the advice. But if they have paid dearly for the advice, that incentivizes and motivates them in a different, in a better way. So I guess within those constraints, I agree completely with what Seth is saying, that you know, stuff that's cheap or free can often be just devalued, despite the fact that it might have life-changing potential. Like, you know, if someone gave you some like free advice that had the potential to change your life, but you ignored it, it might be because of the price that you paid for it that you ignored it.
Right. I think there's a number of reasons why we, not just you and I, but everybody, miss opportunities on a daily basis because they lack context, or they lack sort of that warm glow of like, this is important information. Like there's no external person there to tell you, wait, stop what you're doing. Listen up to this. This is really important. And price is one of the things that will signal it. I think the thing that I find difficult about his advice, first of all, I agree with it. And also, I think anybody who wants to tell better stories should like get out a pen and paper and listen to everything Seth does, because he's amazing at it. But one of the things that I think is difficult about this advice is, like, I've seen online marketers, whom I won't name, although it's tempting, who just say, charge 10 times more than you're charging now, because people will get more out of what you're doing. And I think what that ignores is any personal responsibility you have as a service provider to do better. And, you know, I don't know where that line is, other than to say charging more is only one of many ingredients. Although I do find that when I quote higher prices, typically there's way less pushback, way less negotiation. There's more of a feeling of, oh, this guy's important or worth it.
I think part of that, this is just a theory that I have, is a sort of survivorship bias on the part of, if you're charging much, much, much higher prices, then the pool of clients who could afford that is smaller. And I think it's biased to include companies that know how to, like, I think you and I were talking about this, like, they know how to buy advice. Like, they know how to do that.
Right.
And they know how to implement what they get in terms of advice, or they know how to spend wisely so that that, you know, what might seem like an outrageous amount of money they're spending is, like, they're making the smart decisions to apply that money in a smart way. And I think that also contributes to getting better results. And that has nothing to do with you, other than you decided to charge a lot. Like, I think you're tapping into a sort of pre-selected pool of clients that are just more likely to be successful in everything they do.
Well, that's just it. Our mutual friend, Josh Duty, recently commented, he was like, you know, if you're charging X, whatever X is, say $1,000 a month for whatever you do, some clients will see that as potentially backbreaking, and others will say, oh, that's the, this is the term he used. Oh, that's just a rounding error in my business. This must not be for me.
Right.
Right. Like I won't feel that at all. No, thanks. There must be someone much better out there. And I think what's important to realize is, for me, at least, when I think about if I can put a premium rate in order to increase the likelihood that someone will have a transformation, because that's my goal ultimately, is to give someone a transformation, a major life change, whether that's personally or within their business, whatever it is, you know, whatever is premium, I think, is relative to who I'm serving also. I can't just say now I'm $1 million a month and expect a small business to pay that. I mean, obviously that's not going to happen.
Yeah, right.
So how do you approach, and one thing I have in mind is your, a nice meal, something, a mortgage, something about your pricing
structure. Oh, I just wanted to quickly add that, you said that you can't just jack up your price arbitrarily. And I think about the fact that, I'm trying to change this, but I pay $100 a month for web hosting to be able to host three websites with a premium hosting provider known as Pagely. Excuse me, Pagely. I don't know. They don't know, they no longer offer that hosting plan. I think they're trying to get out of what they perceive as a low end business. So now, like, their smallest hosting plan is like $500 a month. It's managed hosting. It's, you know, it's sort of, they were in the same ballpark, I suppose, as WP Engine, but now they're, I think, trying to move up market. When I pay that much, I have expectations about what I'm going to get.
Right.
I expect my website to be lightning fast. I expect support to be back to me in like 5 minutes, 24/7. You know, I have expectations. So that's why you can't just arbitrarily jack up your price, because that high price is going to come with a bundle of expectations attached to it. You need to be able to deliver that kind of experience. I think there's premium pricing, and then there's like luxury good pricing, where the expectations are even different than just premium pricing.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, I'm working with a client right now who has kind of a, you know, we're the premium offering type orientation in their particular market. It's a local business. And one thing that's crucial, and because I was tackling the marketing and sales program, and what we were looking at is they're trying to automate away the entire thing where, you know, someone signs up as a lead and then they get like three automated emails. And, you know, I asked them, I said, you know, does this feel like a white glove experience to you if you're on the receiving end of that and you want to do $1 million or $2 million project? Oh, good point. And so I think the idea that I'd really like to get to is, sure, placebo is real. There's absolutely no doubt about it. What we think affects how we act and even how our body acts. However, it will come with an increased set of expectations as well. And so it can't be just one thing. There's got to be a whole system that gets altered when you think about changing up your pricing.
Yeah. So you'd asked me for info on how I set prices, and it's kind of dumb, but it speaks to this idea that it's scaled to the type of people I serve. And so I think about their household budget, because as our mutual friend Josh Judy has said, I just love this term. I don't know how he came up with it, but you know, we think about businesses that sell, there are businesses that sell to consumers. Those are B2C businesses. And then there's businesses that sell to other businesses, like, you know, a beer distributor, for example. That's B2B, right? And then there's the kind of businesses you and I run, which Josh called B to little C, or sorry, B to little B. Mm-hmm. So business to little business. And it's just so perfect, because I think it is a different category. You know, the people I sell to, they're running a business, but if they're going to invest in going to a conference or getting some training or anything that is a fits the category of a business investment, they kind of think of it as coming out of their own pocket.
Right.
And that's a real different sort of spending mindset. It's different in terms of making buying decisions than, you know, a company that's like, yeah, you know, we've got $50,000 allocated for this. We're just, we've been planning on this for 6 months. You know, it's just a different decision under those circumstances. So my prices fit into three categories. One is the price of a nice meal out. And of course, I'm doing some sort of rough averaging. Like, you know, I have clients who make, you know, a really maybe upper hundred thousands salary. And I have others who are scraping by at, you know, more like 40 or 50. So, and I don't know that like all of their personal income, but that's a sort of rough idea to give you the idea that, you know, we're talking about a sort of solid middle class, I guess, to upper middle class income might be a way to put that. So, I sell things that cost about what a meal out on town would cost. I sell things that cost what, what a car payment might cost, or a car payment for a nice car. That's the second category of prices. And then I sell things that might cost the same as somebody's mortgage for a house. And then I sell things that are those prices charged on a month by month basis. So, you know, I have clients whose lifetime value is in the $5,000 to $7,000 range, where I don't think they would ever pay that much money in one lump sum. So that's a way of me sort of scaling my pricing to fit the, I guess, the demographic, you would say, that I primarily sell to.
Yeah. So you started this by talking about increasing your value. And we don't need to rehash your conversation with David C. Baker, because people should go listen to the Consulting Pipeline podcast and hear that whole thing. But, you know, a few people may be wondering kind of, well, what's behind that? How do I start to get at increasing my value? And when I think about that, you know, I'm always looking at, all right, how can I continue to boil down? How can I continue to get closer to what are the preconditions to a business surviving, thriving, and growing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I can share my own example of how I've done this, and maybe we will end up segueing into how do you make major changes in your business. But
that was our planned topic for this podcast.
That was,
we'll see if we get there.
We'll break the third wall and let people know what's actually going on our Trello board. Yeah. When I think about increasing my value, you know, one of the things I thought was, well, you know, where does revenue come from? Obviously, as I thought about digital marketing, you know, it's definitely you need leads, right? But no one really wants leads. People want sales. They want revenue. They want money coming in the door. And they want to do it as, I don't want to say easy, although I think most people would say, yeah, if it were easy, I would do that. Give me that way. Give me the easy way. And so when I thought about value, you know, one thing you can do is just align yourself with the value in the business. Like what is the business producing that's most valuable? You know, another thing is, I think, uniqueness. So, you know, I think of people who are the only consultant who does X in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a way to increase value and then become known for that, because certainly you have a limited time to be the only whatever in the world, because if it's valuable, other people will do it too. So I think there's lots of ways to become more valuable, but for me, the approach has always been, what can I do less of that's more impactful? Mm-hmm. And just keep asking that question. How do you approach this question, Philip?
Maybe a little differently. I'm in a period where I'm really trying to get more clear about how I think about this and more able to tell some kind of story or just explain it to people better. So here's where I'm at. I think that there's this world where what you do is you help people, you help businesses or people within businesses make better decisions. And to me, that is how you create more value. If I had to simplify it down to just a single simple idea, I would say that helping them make better decisions is the primary source of value that people like us can start to do more of. It's a whole different category than I'm going to write a better converting landing page. I'm going to write a better performing email onboarding sequence.
Right.
And within that category of like creating or building or making things, either with or for your client, I think there's ways to, you know, move up the value chain. But to me, there's this kind of whole different world of value, which is about helping businesses make better decisions. And that's really, if I'm honest, that's what I'm overtly trying to help my clients do. I'm like pushing them in that direction, even if they don't want to go there. I'm like encouraging them to consider how they might start doing some of that.
You know, I agree with you. And kind of what I'm thinking is one of the reasons I wanted to go into coaching and advisory and away from making things is making things have a beginning and an end, right? Mm-hmm. They decay over time, whatever you right. make.
Yeah.
You know, a better sort of what you're saying is if someone says, hey, I want this thing done, rather than saying, oh, I could do that thing and I can do it faster, better, you know, maybe cheaper even. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying that, you say, well, why do you want to do that thing?
Right. Is it worth doing?
Right. Should we even be doing that?
Have you really thought this through?
Right. Right.
And you're wonderful at getting people to ask those questions. You're just so gifted, I think, at asking these very simple questions that just arrest people's forward motion for long enough for them to consider the big picture or consider the deeper reasons why they're barreling down this path.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess I'm, as I think about increasing my value, I do agree with you. It is about getting people to make better decisions. And I also think for me, I guess maybe this is the same thing, but I always think, like, I did this webinar on how to meet sales objections. Mm-hmm. And I could have showed up and just said, here's a script for 10 sales objections. Go say this. But my approach to this is always to say, I want you to understand how I think about this and how you could think about it.
Right.
And if you buy into my thought process, you'll have a much more powerful tool than a script, because you'll know how to do it yourself. You'll know how to construct the next thing that comes up.
Yeah. And I see that in myself too. More and more I realize the answer to a lot of questions that I get asked starts with the words, here's how I think about that. Mm-hmm. Now I may move on to say, you know, based on that, I would choose this, or I think you should choose this for the following reasons, or if you do this, these are going to be the risks and the rewards and the consequences. If you do this other thing, this is a different thing you're facing. So I try to help people think it through for themselves. That's just kind of my personality, is I don't really think it's my job to make decisions for my clients, at least not the way I've set things up. I want to help them make better decisions. And part of that is giving them the sort of training in thinking about this stuff that they've never had to consider, so that they can arrive at their own conclusions. Part of that's driven by the fact that my clients will largely fail to act on external decisions about the purpose of their business. And
right.
who wouldn't? You know, if you woke up one day, that's like having a job all over again. And that's not why they got into this business. So part of it's driven by necessity, and part of it's just my preference and my personality. I would just rather, I'm like, you're a grown up. You can make this decision for yourself. Let me just help you think it through in a way that you're confident about the resulting decision, and therefore you're likely to stick with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So do you ever resist the urge to just tell people what to do? Maybe you don't have that urge, but some people want just to know. Just tell me what to do, Philip.
Well, that almost never happens. If somebody did say those exact words, I would say, well, here's what I would do in your shoes. So I do that sometimes. Yeah, I have that urge, even if they don't set me up for that, even if they're like, I just don't know. Sometimes I'll do that as a way to kind of get their thinking out of that logjam,
right,
of like fear and uncertainty. Is I'll say, well, you know, if I was in your shoes, this is what I would do. And I'll try to kind of tell them a story of what that decision might look like if they did make the same decision that I'm suggesting. But that doesn't happen a lot. Most of the time people buy into the way I want to help them do this, because it fits. Like it's not a stupid outside imposition. It makes sense for how they want to run their business. So yeah, I don't have that too much. But also I'm not just like walking around with ideas for how everybody should do things differently. That's just kind of not my personality.
Right. Well, and I mean, it's funny you say, if I was in your shoes, usually my response is, well, have you thought about doing it this way? Right.
Yeah.
Or,
which is also great. It's just like, here's another option. What do you think about this?
Yeah. Because have you read Decisive by the Heath brothers?
No, I read, was it Built to Stick? I've read one of their books, but not that one.
Well, so this book is all about how people make decisions and how to make better ones. And I find, at least for myself, that usually the reason I'll make a bad decision is either because I rushed it, it was too impulsive, or I didn't entertain all of the realistic options that were there, right? I missed something. I didn't think about something that was a viable alternative to what I ultimately decided to do. Right. And I find, I guess I'm coming around to the idea that I completely agree with you about helping people make better decisions in their business, because no matter, and I think they're decisions related to X, right? So for you, I think it's decisions about, actually, let me ask you that. Do you think it, when you say your value increases as you help people make better decisions, is that in any aspect of their business, or is it mostly related to how they market and position themselves for you?
Well, that's, head over to my LinkedIn profile. I just changed the headline yesterday, and I want you to read what the new headline is, if I may be so bold.
I'm going. LinkedIn is loading.
Loading. Feels like an old Xbox game when it takes like 620 seconds to load, doesn't it?
Yeah. Also, side note, I just saw my old... Oh, yeah. Okay. I help small dev shops make better positioning decisions.
So I have scoped it to positioning, even though I do work also around lead generation. But that, I just, you know how it is with a headline and with a positioning statement as well. You have to make choices about what's there. And that means you have to exclude stuff sometimes. So I think the kind of prevailing idea around lead generation is, oh, this guy's going to, you know, do kind of what Jake Jorgeven does or something like that. He's going to do done for you lead generation. And that's not at all what I do. So, it feels quite reasonable for me to say I help you make better positioning decisions. So I do scope it. I'm not like a general all up business advisor. There are people who do that. In fact, David C. Baker is much closer to that. But, you know, he's got 20, 30 years experience doing what he's doing. So I'm not going to claim to have that such broad expertise in all aspects of operating a business. And I'm perfectly happy just focusing that narrowly. So that's how I do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have this tendency, which is not a good one, towards a little bit of like binary black and white thinking sometimes. I have to compensate for that. But when I think about how you can create value for clients, I think, okay, you can do something they don't want to do or they're not capable of doing. And there's plenty of value to be created there. There's plenty of revenue to be realized by doing that kind of stuff. But what's left, I mean, is there anything else? And is that anything else more valuable? And to me, that's where you start looking at helping people make better decisions. I mean, there's decisions and there's taking action on those or not taking action on them. I know that's a dramatic oversimplification of the world, but that's why I think about it this way.
Yeah. I mean, I think I tend to agree with you. Like when I think about the value that I bring, value being loosely defined as helping people make better decisions, I think it is much more related to revenue generating activities. So marketing, selling, obviously, you know, I'm a sales coach and consultant. And what's interesting is the way most people find me, and I'm sort of expecting this to happen eventually, is people go, hey, I found you on LinkedIn, or I read this thing you did. Like, how'd you do that? How can you help me do more of that? But, you know, I think that I agree with you. That's where most of my value lies. And I'd rather deepen my value in those areas to be seen as more of a go-to resource in those particular areas rather than spread myself thin, because certainly operations are not my strong suit, or management. Like, I don't really want to do management at all.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm by myself, except for my dog.
Yeah. I do think that what Seth said about price being correlated with what, I mean, would it be fair to say, I haven't listened to that episode, by the way, so I don't know. Price is correlated with follow through. Is that a sort of fair way to sum up his argument?
No, he didn't say that. He was just saying,
remind me.
So basically, it's very well established that, like, if you charge more for, say, a food product, like Starbucks is a great example, right? You charge more for coffee, people are more likely to think that the coffee is delicious, right?
Okay, so he's talking about price as a signaling mechanism, like before the sale or even after, just in the experience. It influences the experience is what he's saying.
Yes, that price on average will convey psychic benefits to the person in their enjoyment of the product.
Okay, got it. Well, I was going to try to make some application. I think it still applies that if what you're selling is helping people make better decisions and they paid a premium price for that assistance with the decision making, I think that will influence their, you know, it'll confer psychic benefits on what happens after. Mm-hmm. Where I think they'll be like, oh, this was really good advice, or, you know, I am really going to work hard to follow through and make this work. I think that still applies to what we're talking about here.
I think so, yeah. And I think that, again, I think price is a signaling mechanism. And I do think that there's a limit to how much you can charge and stay in the same market. Certainly you could charge whatever you want, right? But eventually you're going to price yourself out of your existing market.
Yeah.
But I think I agree that generally lower price just creates lots of problems, not only for you as a business owner, but for your clients as well, right? Because I think there's a relationship dynamic that happens when you're seen as a little bit more expensive.
I think so. I mean, I don't have data on this, but if there's a way for me to collect it, I would be shocked if the people who have bought a $49 book from me have taken more action on that than the people who've spent $600 on a workshop. I would think it's the opposite, that the workshop people are more likely to take action and meaningfully improve their business. But I have a few examples of people who've never given me a dime, or who've gotten a book for free, and it, like, you know, according to them, changed their life. So they can, it's, you know, there's exceptions to everything, but, in general, I think if it stings a little bit to pay the price for advice or assistance with something, you will have a different relationship with it. I think that's something I could say as a generalization. Mm-hmm. And probably a more productive relationship with that, you know, that contractor or advisor or freelancer or whatever.
So how soon before you triple your prices is the question.
I don't have any plans to do that. I recently raised the price on my positioning accelerator program. Uh-huh. That went from $450 a month to $500. It had started out at $300 a month, like, years ago. I think that was, I don't know, back 2016, I think summer of 2016 might have been when I started that. So, you know, it's inched up. I don't know what the percentage difference is between $300 and $500, but
67%.
Okay. So I have increased that price. That's a meaningful, but I'm just not like the kind of, I mean, you should tell me, you should call me on some BS here. You should give me some tough love if I need it. But I really do want my services to be accessible to as many of the right people as possible.
Right. Yeah.
And so I would rather increase my revenue through scaling type stuff, doing group events, running workshops, that kind of thing, rather than, you know, just inching up my price. If I was doing client services, I would be saying something completely different, but I'm not. Mm-hmm.
So, and what's the distinction with client services?
Oh, if I was, I mean, as you know, I spent time writing web copy and email sequences and sort of being essentially a copywriter for, pretty similar market to the one you're going after. And if that was what I did, you bet I would just be trying to increase my prices as much as possible, because for me, that activity is highly unscalable. Mm-hmm. I can't do that for very many people. So, I think that's true of a lot of copywriters, because, you know, especially these direct response copywriters are always bragging about how expensive their services are. I think part of that is just applying their own BS to themselves. But
yes,
I think part of it is if you really are good at that, I don't think you can have 10 clients at once. I think you might have one or two clients at once.
I agree.
So it's just, it's mentally taxing, demanding work. So you have to increase your prices to make that work from a business perspective. But that's not what I'm doing. So I feel like I can get away with very modest price increases and looking for wins in revenue in other ways through scalability and, you know, selling more books and that kind of thing.
That's what I was going to say is, you know, if I think if I were your coach, I would say, I'd probably say, you know, like how fast do you need more revenue? Because if you don't need it fast, then it's got to all be about scale and increasing your footprint in terms of the number of people who follow and listen to you. Because that's, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, man. I just was getting warmed up. Go ahead.
You're loading up for that one. I could see it. Yeah, no. So the idea being really your scale would be coming through a high volume of low under four figure sales. Like I would think that that would be your primary source of scalability in the long run.
Yeah, for sure. I have clients who are on this model. We're talking about this pricing model. We're talking about at above 5,000 in lifetime revenue, but, and that would continue. But I agree completely. I was going to say, I was getting wound up to kind of deliver what is a little bit of a joke. It's gross, but it's like a startup where the way that startup is operating, these tech startups, where what they're going for is massive reach of like scale with users. So they have this funding coming in, and the funding's job is not to build a business that makes money next month or next year even. It's to build a business that has like ownership of all these users, quote unquote ownership, so that they can sell essentially. Right. And in a way, what I'm doing is similar in that the revenue I'm making now is so I can develop this bigger thing that's much more scalable, that specialization school. And so I'm okay with sort of deferring. This is what we were talking about essentially the other day, where we were talking about kind of deferred profitability. I'm okay with that model. So the activities I'm doing this month are all about, well, let me make just, you know, kind of enough money for now so that I can devote a lot of unpaid time to building this thing that I really believe is going to be profitable later. Mm-hmm. It's not that my business is unprofitable. It's just I am... And maybe I'm fooling myself. I'm completely open to that idea. But I really do think I'm just kind of like self-funding or self-bootstrapping something. It's not a tech startup at all. I'm not building a software product, but I am kind of building a training program or a training product or an experience. So in that sense, it is a bit like the way those startups, operate during those startup years.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. The more I learn about what I'm doing now, because I've only been a professional coach and sort of a professional advisor for months, not years, is the trust curve is awful to overcome. So that's not to say that I'm not having success, you know, with new relationships, because that's not the case. I am having success with it. It's just, you know, I look at, I think Jonathan Stark sent out an email yesterday that said, I just got this email from a longtime reader. And the person starts by saying, I've been reading your stuff for 2 years. And I thought, you know, I've got people like that who've been following me for 4 years, 5 years. Well, not 5 years, but say three to four years. Mm-hmm. And only recently have they come and said, man, I really love what you're doing. And I think I'd be ready to engage with you pretty soon.
Yeah. There's that client incubation period, and it can be quite lengthy with the type of stuff you and I do, because this, I hope this is not true of you, but I'm going to just cop to this. What I sell, my services to my clients, they are important, but almost never urgent.
Yep.
And it's so much more fun to sell something that is both important and urgent.
Well, yeah, because people buy it more often and faster. Yeah,
exactly. Right. You know, our mutual acquaintance, Kurt Elster, you know, people come to him and they have the Shopify store and they're like, let's dance. You know, we're ready to do something about this now. Right. And I, if people come to me in that place, it's usually because things are going badly and there's a situation I need to help them turn around.
Right.
So, most people who come to me, they're like, yeah, I've been thinking about this for years and I think I'm ready to do something about it. So that tells me the urgency of is low. It's just gotten gradually creeped up over this threshold and they're ready to take action. I hope that's not true of you, but I suspect that it might be similar. And if that's the case, I can tell you that that incubation period of clients can be, you know, multiples of years. You just have to have enough people in your sort of orbit so that there's enough eggs hatching to, you know, keep things going for you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly getting there. That's one of the reasons I've focused on subscribers and lead generation early on this year.
Yeah.
But what I'll say, and you, I'd love to hear your opinion on this. I think that if I'm selling sales consulting and well, sales coaching, and I'm starting to kind of build like similar to what you have in your structured program, where I'm kind of going, here are all the pieces that you would need to have in place. I'm not saying you have to do it in this exact order, but this is what a healthy organization looks like.
Yeah.
Right. I suspect that because I'm talking about sales, that's my primary lens or frame for how to improve a business. That feels more urgent to most businesses than positioning. That's my guess.
This is not an insult to my clients at all, but you are dealing with, because you're dealing with large organizations, they're just more professionally operated. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not like a backhanded insult to my clients. It's just a facet of the fact that my clients are less mature businesses. They're newer, they're smaller. They don't have like a management layer that's separate from the get it done layer. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're going to have less of an urgency problem. And I don't see it as a problem really for me. I just have had to weather a very long incubation period, whereas I don't think you're going to have as much of a problem with that. So basically I agree that I think with more professionally run organizations, within 3 months, they'll be looking at balance sheets and stuff like that. And they'll be like, this is, we have a problem here. We need help with this, like, in a short time frame, 2-3 months, we got to be turning this around or seeing meaningful improvement. You know, solo freelancers, I'm one of them. So, I mean, I don't call myself a freelancer, but my business looks a lot like my client's business. And we will let problems fester for years before right. we do something about it.
Well, and one thing, I think one thing that you and I share, Philip, in terms of, so I've been spending a lot of time thinking about trigger problems. And so this is a jobs to be done concept. And a lot of people get this wrong because I'll ask like, what are the triggers? And they're like, well, my clients are people who, and I'm like, no, no, no. A trigger is like an event in time. It's something that's happening.
Yeah, right.
And I think you and I share this, which is, a lot of service businesses from 1 to even 100 people rely on a very small number of clients to get almost all of their work. And then they occasionally get things in between, but they don't have any proactive approach, right? And so one thing I'm going to do is message around this idea of getting more control and proactivity in your business through having a professionalized sales program or BD program. And so I'm going to make it really freaking painful for people to think about all of the control that they're giving up and all of the proactivity that they're losing. And, you know, I think there may even be some economic messages around there in terms of like, you know, we're overdue for a downturn in the economy. And are you prepared for that? Because businesses who have something proactive set up are much more likely to survive.
This is from David C. Baker. That's what he calls that, a client concentration issue. He's got, you know, he's seen over somewhere around 1,000 firms. And if one client represents more than 35% of billings, then if you lose that one client, half of firms will fail as a result of that.
Yeah.
That's pretty well researched. And so to me, that dovetails perfectly with what you're saying about the consequences of inaction or not taking this seriously for your clients.
Right. I mean, recently I talked to a business owner who gets 90% of his 7+ figure business from one single client. And so that's
terrifying. That would keep me, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night.
It's scary. I mean, and you know, I think I shared with him that my dad ran a business that was very similar to that. I mean, he basically had 2 clients in this environmental testing business, and they were Shell Oil and ExxonMobil. And, you know, the day came when every 3 or 4 years when they would renegotiate, and he had no leverage, right? Mm. They would just come in and they'd be like, why don't you cut your prices 40%? And he'd go, yeah, I guess I need to figure out if I can do that or not.
Here, hand me that sheet. I'm going to scratch that price right out, put in the price we want right to pay.
By the way, I really like your shoes. Can you leave those on the way out?
we're going to be in the neighborhood this weekend. Can you make dinner for us?
Yeah, exactly.
the not nice way to say that is you're their bitch. And it's just, I've been there and I have actually had the rug pulled out from underneath me in situations like that. And it's why I would not be able to sleep at night with that sort of thing going on. And honestly, it's part of that anxiety about losing a whale client is not an insignificant part of my decision-making to focus on a larger number of small clients. That's to me a much more comfortable business. And since I've done that, my revenue has never been more stable. Mm-hmm. It's not the exact same every month, but it's so much more stable.
Yep. I agree. Well, Philip, I think we've covered it. We've gone a little bit all over the place today, but we mostly were talking about premium pricing and the impacts it has on your business. And I would just wrap up by saying that charging a little bit more is better for you and it's better for your clients because, and this is backed by mountains of research, obviously you're going to have an easier time running your business and therefore have the opportunity to think about how to serve people better and bring more value to the table. And your clients have more invested, more skin in the game, and that's good for them too.
Yeah, I agree. We've covered a lot of the caveats on that, so I don't think we need to reiterate those. And I think that I'm thankful for Seth bringing that up so that we could tell him what's what on that subject.
And I think next time we're going to focus on how to make big changes to your business and how to evaluate those and move forward with them, because that was our original intention and we didn't cover it at all. And we're here an hour later.
That's fun. Well, it was a fun conversation. Good talking to you about this stuff, buddy.
Good talking to you too, Philip. See ya.
Bye.